Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Take a walk in somebody else's shoes with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe. Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Are you ready for some magic?
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 2nd of January, these are our main stories. Israel's Supreme Court has annulled controversial judicial reforms that triggered months of protests against Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Thousands of people in central Japan have spent the night in evacuation centres following a powerful earthquake and a small tsunami. The Pope has condemned the recent arrests of Roman Catholic priests and bishops in Nicaragua. Also in this podcast, we take you to the Austrian mountains. The Supreme Court in Israel has struck down judicial reforms that were a centrepiece of Benjamin Netanyahu's agenda in government. The legislation limited the court's powers to overturn government decisions that it judged to be unconstitutional. The reforms led to months of mass demonstrations in Israel by opponents who said that they would prevent the proper oversight of the government. One of the protest organisers described the court's decision as a victory in the battle to protect democracy in the country. Paul Henley spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Shaima Khalil, and asked her how much of a blow was this court judgment for the Israeli Prime Minister, especially in the light of the current war in Gaza.
It's a significant blow because it yet again threatens to further undermine confidence in his government. Remember, there were, before the war, before October the 7th, there was a huge showdown, really, between the country's highest court, the Supreme Court, when the 15 judges, in the first time in its history, decided to convene and make a decision on this judiciary overhaul that Netanyahu's government had introduced and had suggested. So hundreds of thousands of Israelis take to the streets against his government, calling for him to resign. And at the time, at the heart of all of this was what is now known as the reasonableness bill. In July, the government pushed this reasonableness bill. And essentially what it is, it has curtailed or has stopped the power of the Supreme Court, as well as lower courts in Israel, to cancel government decisions deemed extremely unreasonable. So essentially it took away the power from the Supreme Court for a mechanic of checks and balances. And at the time, it caused a great deal of division in Israel. The opponents of this decision by the government say that it undermined democracy, it undermined the independence of the judiciary and its ability to keep the government and those in power in check. But the supporters of the Netanyahu government, which is the most right-wing government in Israel's history, they essentially said that the court was intervening too much, that it had too much power to stop decisions by elected officials, by the elected government. And so now we have a situation where the Supreme Court has decided that it does have that power, that it has overturned the government's decision. And now, again, it's given itself, if you will, that power back to keep the government in check.
If Mr. Netanyahu is gone as Prime Minister once the war in Gaza is over, are the reforms gone too?
The reforms have been passed and introduced by Mr. Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition. It depends on who comes to power. Is it going to be another right-wing coalition of some sort? Is it going to be a completely different government and different ruling party? But we're at a point right now where we're also waiting for what the Netanyahu government is going to do. For example, the justice minister, who is seen essentially as the architect of these reforms, has criticized the court, saying that announcing this right now during the war is just not in the spirit of unity for Israel. And so, of course, they're extremely unhappy. They can't appeal it because this is a Supreme Court decision, but what they can do is ignore it. But if they do that, then that sends Israel internally into a constitutional crisis at the time of war.
Shaima Khalil. Thousands of doses of vaccines against childhood diseases have been delivered to Gaza to help tackle a growing health emergency there. As the conflict in the territory continues, Israel said on Friday that it would facilitate the entry of the vaccines through Rafah to help prevent the spread of disease. Germs are spreading quickly in overcrowded shelters where clean water is rare or unavailable. And the Israeli military offensive has severely disrupted immunizations against polio and measles, amongst other diseases. Ayadil Sapabekov is the World Health Organization's head of health emergency in Gaza. He says the situation is becoming critical.
Vaccine is the most effective public health tool for prevention of outbreaks of various infectious diseases, especially among the vulnerable population as we have in Gaza right now, where thousands of people live together in overcrowded camps with very poor water conditions, poor hygiene, and very poor sanitation. These are all breeding grounds for various diseases. And some of those diseases could be quite deadly, especially for young children. Measles, polio, meningitis, hepatitis, and others. We have not yet registered any outbreak which is laboratory confirmed, but because the situation in Gaza is difficult and it's not possible to laboratory confirm any disease that we may have. What we do as a WHO, we suggest that the Ministry of Health and also our UNRWA partners is to use so-called syndromatic approach, where you see the diseases and clinically detect it before you do any laboratory confirmation. Unfortunately, even if we do the laboratory confirmation, for us, it's also very difficult to control the outbreak of any disease that may have happened. So for the moment, we have more than 180,000 cases of upper respiratory tract infections. We have around more than 200 suspected cases of measles. Again, I repeat, this is suspected cases because the health system in Gaza is unable to currently confirm those cases, which is very bad also. We have more than 200,000 cases of suspected diarrhea. And again, we don't know the origin of those diseases.
Ayadil Sapabekov from the WHO, who's currently in Rafah in southern Gaza. Next to Japan, and thousands of people have spent the night in evacuation centres following a powerful earthquake. It measured 7.6, striking the centre of the country and causing scores of buildings to collapse and major damage to infrastructure. Four people are reported to have died, and there are fears others are trapped beneath rubble. But a warning that the earthquake could trigger a devastated tsunami was later downgraded. Our former Asia correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, reports.
Wow, it's huge. Oh!
You can hear the shock in the voice of this foreign tourist as the earthquake begins shaking a ski resort in the central mountains of Japan. The shaking is severe, triggering landslides and bringing down buildings near the epicentre. This tourist from Taiwan, Johnny Wu, is staying at the ski resort.
Suddenly, it gets pretty strong. You can see all the snow from the electric wire goes down, and also from the roof go down, and all the car is shaking. So everybody was panicked that time.
The shaking is followed by an even more frightening threat. Japan's meteorological agency declares a tsunami may be heading for the coast. A large tsunami is being observed, the official says. People in coastal areas or along rivers are asked to evacuate to higher ground immediately. In Japan, this is everyone's worst nightmare. It immediately brings back memories of what happened on March the 11th, 2011, when a huge 15-metre tsunami smashed into the northeast coast, killing nearly 20,000 people and devastating the Fukushima nuclear power plant. There are tense hours as thousands flee their homes and seek shelter on higher ground. As night falls, the tsunami warning is lowered. The big one has not materialised. But with aftershocks continuing to strike, people are told not to return home. Many are now spending the night sheltering in cars or in the open, with temperatures below zero. To Jeffrey Hall, a lecturer in the city of Yokohama, it is all distressingly reminiscent of his experience in 2011.
The house that I was in, I could feel heavy shaking about 2 minutes long. And I could tell, even though it wasn't near me, that this was a big earthquake. It was the exact same experience I had in Tokyo over 10 years ago. You just feel something is very long and you know that this has been a terrible earthquake somewhere, but not close.
The threat of a tsunami has now passed, but the damage is severe. The Noto Peninsula that sticks out into the Sea of Japan is cut off. Older houses have been brought down, roads torn up. An unknown number of people are trapped under collapsed buildings. Just how much damage has been done is still unclear. As in 2011, it could be some days before the scale of the destruction can be fully assessed.
Well, for more on this latest earthquake in Japan, we've been speaking to James Jackson, who's a professor of active tectonics at the University of Cambridge here in the UK.
This was an earthquake quite large on the west coast of Japan, so not on the east coast. So it's a different geological situation from the one in 2011. The one in 2011, it was to do with the Pacific seafloor sliding underneath Japan. And that happens all the way around the Pacific. The seafloor slides underneath the surrounding land, rather like an escalator. When it reaches the top of the staircase, it just slides back into the earth again. And that's what happens with the Pacific seafloor on the east side of Japan. And that's what was responsible for the 2011 earthquake. This is on the other side, on the west coast. And it's a different business altogether. It's quite shallow for a start. You don't get deeper earthquakes. And it's about Japan actually crumpling up. So it's getting squashed. It does so along the east coast there. This is not a surprise in the sense that the last big one, rather similar to this, was in 1964 at Niigata, which is just about 100 kilometers along the coast from here. So people are used to this. I mean, they've had in the last 30, 40 years, they've had six or seven, not quite as big as this, but they're certainly aware that these things are frequent. I mean, Japan is really admired and respected around the world for being so good at preparing for these things, preparing the population, teaching children and the public what to do and how important it is. And yes, it's a tragedy if anyone's died, and there will be a lot of damage and it will cost a lot of money, but it is a triumph that you can have an earthquake this size and very few people are actually going to get killed. As this say, put it in perspective, this is not much smaller than the earthquakes in southeast Turkey and Syria at the start of the year. They killed 60,000 people. And it's quite usual in the earthquake belt between the Mediterranean and China, which goes right through the Middle East and the Far East, earthquakes of this size will routinely kill tens of thousands of people. That's just never going to happen in Japan. And that is tremendous. And that is, you know, an enormous tribute to the integrity of the building industry and everything else in Japan. They take these things extremely seriously.
James Jackson from the University of Cambridge. Austria's stunning alpine lake region, the Salzkammergut, is one of Europe's cultural capitals this year. It is the first time a rural alpine region has been chosen instead of a city. Over the next 12 months, towns and villages in the area, southeast of Salzburg, will be hosting a range of cultural and artistic projects. The region has a rich heritage in both folk and classical music, as Bethany Bell discovered when she visited the old imperial spa town of Bad Ischl.
Music by the Austrian singer and songwriter Hubert von Geusern, which will feature at the opening ceremony of Salzkammergut 2024, but with a difference. The artist who comes from this region told me he'll be joined by a choir of 1,000 voices, and they'll be yodeling.
I'm very excited when I think of it. I'm very nervous because we have no chance in really rehearsing this. And hopefully when they all get together, I can get them all synchronized. There'll be some 300 on stage, but the rest, 700, they'll be distributed within the audience. There'll be also brass players from all those 23 villages which are involved in this thing. There'll be a very genius percussionist, and myself, I will do some things nobody will expect.
I'm on the shores of Lake Town, which is surrounded by craggy mountains covered in snow. This is where Arnold Schoenberg used to spend his holidays. Mahler, Bruckner, Brahms and Schubert were also very fond of this region. The organisers of the festival are hoping to reawaken some of that creative spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Brugger, a pianist and head of the provincial music school in Bad Gäusern, plays Schönberg on his glass grand piano. This summer, the piano will be taken to the nearby ice caves of the Dachstein Mountains, where works by young composers will be performed. Peter Brugger says it's all about the future.
We are looking for new Arnold Schönbergs here. We want to especially invite women composers. We do not want to speak always about famous artist meeting point of the 19th century. We have to create a new one.
Leo, one of Peter Brugger's students, improvises on his bass clarinet. He's writing a piece for one of the composing competitions run by the Salzkammergut Cultural Capital.
It will be an ensemble piece. It's based on The Little Prince. I'm looking forward to it because I think it's a great opportunity for artists in Salzkammergut.
The opening will also feature a different sound. Cowbells, worn by locals known as Glöcklers, who parade around on the 5th of January to chase away winter. Stefan Pichler is a Glöckler from the town of Laufen.
We walk through the snow from village to village with bells to awake the spring spirits, bringing freedom, peace and happiness.
That report was by Bethany Bell in Austria. Still to come. Fancy being the owner of a cuckoo clock museum? Find out later.
Who would kick off 14 of their best players to defend his race's dignity?
Unmissable stories from around the globe.
I get a call from the moral police. They told me the general wants to talk to you.
The army asked us to leave the house immediately because it was going to be bombed.
Podcasts from the BBC World Service. Search for amazing sports stories, Lives Less Ordinary, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Next to Bangladesh. And as we heard in the earlier podcast, he's a Nobel Prize winner, an economist who spread the concept of small loan schemes and is credited with lifting millions of people out of poverty. But Muhammad Yunus was sentenced on Monday to 6 months in prison by a court in Dhaka. He was convicted of violating labour laws by failing to provide a welfare fund for people working for him. He and three others have been granted bail pending appeals. Addressing a crowd in the city, Mr. Yunus said he was innocent of any crime.
I've been punished for a crime I did not commit. If you want to call that justice, you can. But this tragedy will remain. We've been hurt on this joyous day.
Paul Henley spoke to Irene Khan, a Bangladeshi national and supporter of Muhammad Yunus. She is UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, and she was in court when the sentences were given out.
As I arrived at the building in which the court is located, I could see rings of policemen surrounding the building. We went up to the fourth floor. The courtroom itself was packed. People were pouring out into the corridor. There wasn't even standing room. When the judge entered the room, you could hear a pin drop. People stood there listening to her give a verdict in which a Nobel Peace Laureate, the only Nobel Peace Laureate this country, Bangladesh, has, was convicted to 6 months of imprisonment together with three of his associates.
Why do you call this a travesty of justice?
I call it a travesty of justice because Yunus, we were told by the judge, was not being prosecuted for his Nobel laureate status. He was not being prosecuted for his work as a social activist. He was being prosecuted as chair of a telecom company in Bangladesh, but he is the only chair of the telecom company who has been prosecuted in this manner, that the company failed to set up a welfare fund for its employees. Now, how many companies in Bangladesh could be prosecuted for precisely those grounds and are not being prosecuted?
But just to be clear, you're not denying that this firm did break labour law and his firm did not create a workers' welfare fund. That's not in dispute?
It is disputed. It is heavily disputed by the defence. In the middle of the judgment, his lawyer stood up and protested and disputed every single charge that was brought against him. He himself has said that he has not committed these crimes. The case was rushed through. There are procedural flaws as well as problems with substantive interpretation of the law. And the defense continues to believe that they were not listened. Sufficient evidence was not provided to find him guilty.
Irene Khan, a UN special rapporteur on freedom of expression. Next to Nicaragua. Over the last couple of weeks, at least 14 priests have been arrested in a crackdown on the Roman Catholic Church. It's part of a growing row between the government of Daniel Ortega and the Vatican. And during his New Year address, Pope Francis called for dialogue to overcome the difficulties. I heard more from our Americas editor, Leonardo Rocha.
The timing is important because those arrests happened 2 days ago, the latest arrests. And the Pope said he was following the situation with concern. He asked for prayers and, interestingly, he called for dialogue to try to overcome that situation.
He's been quite outspoken in the past about what's been going on in Nicaragua.
Yeah, earlier in the year 2023, he compared the government of Daniel Ortega, a former Marxist rebel who's been in power for nearly 17 years. He compared his government, what he was doing to the priests there and to other political activists, to Nazi Germany. And he also said that the only explanation for that is that Mr. Ortega was unstable. That's what he said at the time. But now, critically, he's saying that we need dialogue to try to solve the situation.
So as we're saying here, relations between the Catholic Church and Nicaragua and the government there have been pretty strained for a number of years now. Why this latest round of arrests?
Well, I believe that what happened from the 20th of December, that's one bishop that was arrested, is because he mentioned another bishop, a detained bishop, who became sort of a martyr, a symbol of the movement in Nicaragua. He mentioned him in his end-of-year sermon. So I believe the other people, the other priests who were arrested were for the same reason, going to church before Christmas and saying prayers for Bishop Rolando Alvarez. He was sentenced to 26 years in jail in February for treason. That was the accusation from the government. And he has become a sort of a symbol of resistance to the government there.
So this all goes back to 6 years ago when there were opposition protests on the streets about changes to the country at the time. And the Catholic Church has got very involved. Is it quite unusual to get so involved in politics in Latin America?
Well, they were involved before. They were left-wing priests and they were famously involved with a movement in supporting the oppressed and supporting the poor. And it's not unusual for the Catholic Church to get involved. What they did in 2018 was to basically give shelter to people who were being persecuted by the police. And that didn't go down with the Nicaraguan government. That didn't go down well with them.
Leonardo Rocha. The Czech president, Petr Pavel, in his first New Year address, has called for his country to take steps towards adopting the European Union's single currency, the euro. He said it was the logical future for a small, open economy. The Czech Republic joined the EU in 2004 with adoption of the euro as one condition, but successive governments have failed to take the necessary steps. The 1st of January marked 25 years since the launch of the euro currency in Europe.
It's been the day of the euro, the New Year's Day that began a new era for the European Union. Celebrations at the new European Central Bank as 11 countries finally pin their destiny to a single currency.
Well, the euro was first used as a digital currency traded on global markets and used by international traders. The coins and notes came along 3 years later, completely replacing the individual currencies of 11 nations. It was farewell to the franc, the lira, the Deutschmark and the peseta. Jean-Claude Trichet, at the time of the euro's launch, was running the Bank of France and was later the president of the European Central Bank. Sam Fenwick asked him what he makes of the euro's performance 25 years on.
It is obviously a formidable success because the, I would say, expectations were very poor. You had in the UK, in the US, a very large number of economists absolutely convinced that it would be a total failure. I was told 100 times, how would you make a credible currency in merging the DM, the guilder, the franc, the escudo, the drachma, the peseta, the lira? You are much too ambitious and it cannot work.
I understand back then, 25 years ago, when you went to the United States, you had to explain to them what you were doing. They didn't know about the euro.
They were convinced that it was a pure fantasy. In my memory, I would say 7 months before the 1st January 1999, they were very convinced by the articles, by their economists, by a number of Nobel Prize, that it was more or less impossible to make. And they realized that there was a will of the European to go in this direction. And they were very surprised, extremely surprised, obviously.
So when it actually happened, take us back to that day. How did you feel?
For us, it was a technical, formidable challenge because from day one, we had to merge totally our money markets. We have to prepare for the appropriate functioning of this extraordinary endeavor. At the time, we were merging 11 currencies. It was considered quasi-impossible even to succeed.
Did you fear it would fail?
We were not sure it would work. Of course, we had prepared very carefully everything, and I was personally convinced that we would make it.
Why did the European Union want a single currency?
To be sure that you had a single market, a functioning single market, you had on top of all what had been done, which was considerable with a single act and so forth, but you had also to care for avoiding big changes in the value of the various currencies. So if we want really a working single market, we have to emulate the US single market. There is only one currency in the US. And we have to accept that and do that.
But there was also a criticism, wasn't there, that actually it was dominated by Germany. It was effectively a German currency for the rest of Europe.
Well, the German did not think at the time at all that it would be a German currency for the rest of Europe. They considered they were losing the DM. It was extraordinarily difficult. I remember Chancellor Kohl telling his interlocutor, including me, that had he asked with a referendum like the French what was the position of the German public, they would have said, no, we keep the DM. We don't want to trade the DM. It was not that easy to realize that it was an appropriate way to continue to proceed, to achieve the single market, and to go forward.
Jean-Claude Trichet, the former president of the European Central Bank. Now, could you live with a constant ticking and a cacophony of chirping like this every hour? Well, if the answer is yes, then you could be qualified to take over as the owner of Cuckoo Land. It is a museum in Tabley in Cheshire in northwest England, and it's dedicated to the cuckoo clock, 750 of them. The current owners, brothers Roman and Maz Piekarski, have no heirs, but think it's finally time to hand over their collection. Adam Fleming spoke to Roman and asked him where the appeal to cuckoo clocks came from.
When we were little children, my brother and I, in the family home, there was always a cuckoo clock, and we used to watch the old clockmaker from across the road. And come 15, I got an apprenticeship in Manchester, and so did my brother, and for clockmaking and repairing and what have you. And it was during that period of time that we found the first cuckoo clock, but unfortunately we found a really good one. We said, if they made that, just what did they make? I shouldn't have said that. Now we've got over 750 of them.
So if I arrived at the museum, which sadly I've not had the chance to go to yet, just paint a picture of what would await me.
We have some very, very large hunter cuckoo clocks. When I say large, you could get in them sort of thing.
What? You could get in them?
Well, we have a few clocks like that, but these hunter clocks came out of hunting lodges. The animals that are on them are life-size.
What, like a life-size bear? A deer?
And a fox or a deer.
What's your absolute favourite out of the 750?
Oh, I have a clock that all the front is carved out of one piece of wood. I chased it for 2 years. And the day I found it, I got into this clock fair half an hour before anybody else. And I saw it on display, and I just went over to the guys that were selling it, who I knew, and I just said, look, there's €500. We'll meet for a meal later tonight, and we'll do a deal on the clock. He said, right, no problems, Roman. And then the National Museum in Germany and everybody wouldn't talk to me or my brother for 2 years because all they said was, you have our clock. If you can imagine, on the top of the clock there are two hairs, beautiful hairs, sort of looking worried. And down at the bottom under foliage, there is a fox looking up at them. But it's all one piece of wood, the whole front.
Oh, so they sort of tell a story as well.
Oh, most definitely. And we do have clocks that tell them a most wonderful story because we've just received into the collection a clock that is absolutely fabulous. I don't know if you've heard of Lord Kitchener.
Of course, yeah, the famous poster with his pointing finger.
Well, he had a cuckoo clock and he said to his Batman that if anything should happen to me, I know your daughter loves my clock, she must have it. And he died in 1916 on a ship in north of Scotland. And it went to his daughter, and it stayed in that family until they brought it to us and asked us if we'd like to look after it for them. You know, they gave it to us, in fact.
Why is it time, if you pardon the pun, to hand the collection over?
I'm turned 70. My brother's 69. I've had MS for 46 years. I think it's about time I started to take it easy.
Cuckoo clock collector Maz Piekarski. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.